المقدمات in the سطوح for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending بحث الخارج. بحث الخارج, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahth al-Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, trying to help me with the answers to the questions related to the rules of purification based on the fatwas by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, how could a person or an individual who's always doubtful about the validity of one's wudu or their wudu, you know, we know that there are people who get doubtful, who become doubtful of their own acts. Whenever it comes to wudu, they are doubtful whether, for example, they did the mass or not, or when it comes to the prayer, for example, sometimes they think that they miss a rak'ah, for example, right, a unit of the prayer. So how could these people go about their, wudu and when they go to masjid, pray, read the Noble Quran, visit the shrine of the infallibles, alayhi salam?
Well, basically, no attention should be paid to the doubt concerning the state of purity after one is sure that he has performed wudu. And it's very much important for a believer who wants to perform prayers or any other religious acts which require wudu to give the benefit of the doubt to himself and always consider himself to be in the state of purity when he is certain that he has made wudu and that he was in the state of purity. Because there is a principle or a rule which says, which we call istishab, and that means presume the continuity of the previous condition, the previous state. So when we are certain that when I'm, for example, certain that I did make wudu, but then now I doubt whether I'm still in the state of wudu or not, or whether maybe I have done something and that my wudu might have become invalid. Then in such a state, when I'm not certain, I should give the benefit of the doubt to myself, and I should consider myself as being still in the state of ritual purity.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, this kind of obsession, we should fight it. We should fight it. The scholars, the religious authorities have always said that we should not, you should not be so much particular. You should not be obsessive or very much scrupulous
mm-hmm.
when it comes to being in the state of ritual purity, or even when you are someone who doubts very frequently, very often. And he should not pay heed to his doubt, and he should go ahead acting and doing what is to his benefit. And this is a scenario where one has to pay no attention to his doubt, and he should consider himself in the state of ritual purity because he knows that he was in the state of wuzu. And so therefore, performing prayers, reading the Holy Quran, and of course, doing any other amal or acts of religious obligations or devotion, which require wudu, should be without any problem.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back to our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of purification according to fatwas issued by the Khomeini. Well, Sheikh Javed, we all know that we also learned it from our elders. Like when we make wudu, there is always this condition that we are told, like to do the wiping or mass from the elbow downwards to the fingers after pouring or when pouring some water over the elbow, right?
Yeah.
So is this condition necessary, it's sufficient to, have the hands like rolled over and wiped with a wet hand, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is, if the water is sufficient enough, then it's necessary to pour water and make it flow off the fingertip or from wherever it falls off. Okay, but in the event that there is little water, it is sufficient to make the water reach all parts of the skin, and because there is not sufficient water, it's not possible to make the water flow off. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is sufficient water.
It doesn't flow over all areas
of the skin. But what is actually important is to start washing the hands or soaking your hands from the elbow to the tip, and making sure that the all parts of your forearms actually become wet. You know, starting from the elbow to the tip.
Yes.
In the event that there's not sufficient water, but if there is water, of course, you have to pour water. And pouring water means that you have to start pouring, washing your hand from your elbow, washing your arms from the elbow to the tip. And in that case, of course, the water will definitely flow off.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, now a quite relevant question a near question to the point that we were just discussing lately is that in wiping the head,
yes.
Is it sufficient to make the hair wet, or is it obligatory that the moisture from the hand reaches the skin of the head or the scalp as well?
Okay. Of course, the answer given by His Eminence is that, of course, one can do the wiping of the head on the upper part of the scalp or the hair, of course, depending on whether the hair is thick, long or mm-hmm. not. Of course, if the hair is collected on the upper part of the of the head, and then it's not enough. His Eminence says that it's not enough to pass wet hand on it. Okay, rather one must part the hair to do mass on the upper part of the scalp, because you need to make sure that your fingers, your wet fingers, actually touch the scalp, you mm-hmm. know, and or actually the root of the hair, you know, we can call it the base of the hair, because it's necessary to make sure that you either wipe the part near the base or the root of the hair or the scalp,
mm-hmm.
and in the event that the hair is collected or it's very much thick or long, then that means you need to part it into two and pull your finger or your palm in between, and that very portion which is divided, the middle point.
But if the hair is medium size, then yes, there is no need actually
there's
for
no need
parting.
You can just pull down or up, you know, and of course it's always permissible to wipe from top to bottom or from bottom to top.
Mm-hmm.
And either way, wiping is allowed and permissible.
How about the artificial hair? If somebody's wearing wigs, how should they go about their wiping or mass, doing the mass?
Well, we know that wigs are not allowed when performing wudu or performing ghusl, as long as it constitutes or forms a barrier, especially when wiping the front part of the head. If the wigs are there, then you cannot make wudu with the wigs. And His Eminence says that, of course, if the hair is implanted, it is permissible, you know,
because it's part of your natural hair now.
Yeah, it is part of your hair, and of course, it's never possible to remove it because it's implanted.
Yes,
and it is, you know, it is real. It's not synthetic or artificial, so you can wipe on it. But in the event that it is, you know, synthetic or artificial, and of course, it's not natural in any way, then it should be removed, provided that it does not, constitute or involve mm-hmm. unbearable or undue hardship.
Right.
Hardship.
Okay.
And in that case, if it is, you know, His Eminence says that if removing the artificial hair, probably it is glued to the scalp,
mm-hmm.
or it is kind of impossible to remove it.
Yes.
Then in that case, His Eminence says that wiping on that hair is sufficient.
Uh-huh, I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Tawheed, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
The story of Saudi Arabia. Part 4. On November
November 2, 1917, the publication of a letter in the press changed relations between Arab regions forever. The letter, which was written to the most famous person of the British Jewish community, stated that, "Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of the British government that the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet, quote, the British government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use its best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country." Unquote. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. In September of 1918, U.S. President Woodrow Wilson endorsed the Balfour Declaration in a message to the American Jewish community to congratulate them on the Jewish New Year. Damascus was the next target of Allenby, which was even more important than Baghdad and Jerusalem al-Quds, because the conquest of Damascus would help Britain have full control over the Arab parts of the Ottoman Empire. Faisal was gradually replacing his father in ties with Britain because he was more ready to listen to what they said. As time went on, the number of groups Britain promised a share of the Middle East increased. They included Arabs, Syrians, the French, and a new group, namely the Jewish, who were after establishing their own land and government. The time to fulfill those promises was approaching. In late summer 1918, Allenby issued an order to invade Syria. In this battle, Faisal's Arab forces and the battalions of the Jewish Legion both sided with Britain. On October the 1st, the first group under the command of Allenby, which was an Australian brigade, entered Damascus at dawn. Lawrence went to the city, but Faisal was gradually finding out the truth. At a meeting attended by Faisal, Lawrence, and Allenby, Faisal learned about the agreements between Britain and France. Allenby clearly told him, Syria will be under French rule and Faisal will be in charge of managing regions inside Syria under guidance and financial support of France, and Lebanon will not be among them. Faisal strongly protested and left the Victoria Hotel in annoyance. He tried to show off his power to French forces by holding a large parade in Damascus, but was met with a sharp reaction from France and was forced to leave. After this, France took control of the whole of Syria. Now, the first share of the spoils of the Arabian regions that had been previously agreed on was divided. France took Syria and Lebanon. At the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, following all ups and downs, the First World War came to an end. A war that left 10 million people dead and 20 million injured. Troops left the trenches they had digged in the early days of the war and returned home. The trenches, in silence, were awaiting soldiers in the next world war. But something major happened on the map. The borderlines between nations were not the same as they were before the war. The four great empires of the world, which prior to the war had sought to expand their borders or at least preserve them, disintegrated and small countries were born out of them. The German Empire, Austro-Hungary, the Russian and the Ottoman empires no longer existed, neither in the world nor on the map. On June the 28th, 1919, on the fifth anniversary of the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, many of the big powers that had been victorious in the war signed the peace treaty during the Versailles Conference in Paris. Representatives of different nations and ethnic groups rushed to the conference from around the world in the hope that they could gain their independence from the victors of the war. One of them was Faisal, the son of Sharif Hussein, who had attended the conference to see the fulfillment of the promises that he was given during the war. Faisal now knew that Britain and France had agreed 2 years ago to divide the Arab world, exactly at the time when he and his troops were fighting the Ottomans under command of a British officer. Edward Lawrence, the hero of the Arabs, who had earlier been informed of the deal, left the scene slowly. After these events, Britain's friends in Saudi Arabia, namely Sharif Hussein, the Emir of Hejaz, and Abdul Aziz bin Saud, who had now become the Emir of Najd, were strong enemies, each trying to have control over the whole of Saudi Arabia. Abdul Aziz, who had not previously received Britain's attention, started a bloody war with the help of a movement called the Brotherhood, which was a follower of the school of thought of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, to take control of the whole of Saudi Arabia, especially the areas controlled by Sharif Hussein, namely Hejaz. 4 years later, they had conquered the entire Hejaz and Sharif Hussein was forced into exile. Abdul Aziz ibn Saud defeated his enemy Sharif Hussein with the conquest of Mecca in 1924 and Medina in 1925, and in 1926 he declared himself King of the Hejaz and Najd, and in 1932, when he took control of most parts of the Arabian Peninsula, he put the name of his clan on the whole land, and a country called Saudi Arabia was born. After World War I ended, all the Arab regions that were once under the rule of the Ottoman king in Constantinople were divided into new regions through lines on the map, and new nations were born whose stories were mentioned in history books. Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Jordan, Kuwait, Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine. After many ups and downs, Faisal, who was now known as Amir Faisal, became the ruler of Iraq, and his brother Abdullah became ruler of Jordan. And Saudi Arabia, which was once the dream of the two brothers and their father, and was only part of the empire in the Islamic world, fell into the hands of the Saud dynasty. The most important loser in this battle was Sharif Hussein, and the main winner was Abdul Aziz bin Abdurrahman from Al Saud, someone who now ruled all the regions of Saudi Arabia, and a few years later established a unique monarchy for his family after discovering a huge wealth called oil. And that was how the story of Saudi Arabia began.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries and scholars. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh Rouhani, welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Today we want to talk about one of the most outstanding philosophers, also astronomers, a scientist, a polymath, we can call it an Allama of the 7th century Hijra. He is no one but Khwaja Nasiruddin al-Tusi. Al-Tusi is mostly known for his scientific achievements in the Western world, but today we want to talk about his religious aspect of the life, the achievements that he had, the struggles that he made in order to spread Shiite Islam all across Persia, and also the works that he has produced and compiled regarding Islamic teaching. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Khwaja Nasiruddin al-Tusi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Khwaja Nasiruddin al-Tusi, his name was Muhammad bin Hassan al-Tusi.
Yes.
He was born in Tus. Tus is known as, in today's world, we say like Khorasan, or the city of Mashhad, basically.
Yes.
He was from the northern area of, we can say, like Iran. And later he was buried in Qadhimiyya in
yes.
Iraq because of his travelings due yes. to scholarly life that he had.
And also according to his last will,
yes.
he was buried in Al-Qadhimiyya.
So he was buried there.
Yes.
So he initially got his initial, we can say, like studies like Quran, the Arabic grammar, the ethics and all those. When he was too young, and he also had command over the mathematics as well, which he learned from Kamaluddin Muhammad, one of his teachers.
Yes.
And after that, he started to learn about fiqh, the jurisprudence, and the hadith from his father and his grandfather, because obviously they were also from the scholarly family. So later after that, obviously, he also learned the logic and the, we can say, philosophy
yes.
from different teachers as well. So he was quite a person who had gained or learned different sciences
yes.
at different times, and he had command over them. Therefore, we can see like how he got the presence into the into the fort of Ismailiyun.
Yes.
You know, Ismailiyun are the group who used to believe in six imams.
Yes.
And they were also known as Shia.
Yes.
So because of his knowledge, because of his family, and because of his way he learned and he became popular, he was popular amongst the, we can say, like kings, different kings, yes, as well, especially the Shia kings,
yes,
either whichever school they belong to. But
yes,
he, as a scholar, was famous amongst them.
Except Timurids and the Mongols, who ruled over the Persia at that time. But yes, by the grace of Al-Tusi, they also converted into Islam too. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, give us some details about the scholarly life of Al-Tusi. As I said at the beginning, it is divided into two parts. One of them, scientific achievements. The other one are related to the knowledge or the ma'rifah that he compiled some books in this field.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, Khwaja Nasiruddin Al-Tusi was not only, for example, a jurist. He was also a logician, a philosopher, a theologian, a mathematician, an astronomer. You know, in all these different fields of studies, he had written lots of books and works that are available right now. In philosophy, in theology, in mathematics, his works are really outstanding, really useful and helpful. And even nowadays in the Islamic houses, Islamic seminaries, Shiite seminaries, the students refer to his commentaries on Ibn Sina's works as the textbook.
Yes.
Even still, these books are very much useful and helpful for the students of the Hawza and the Islamic seminaries. But one point that I wanted to mention here about the personality and the very important character of Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi is this, that unfortunately, some of the Sunni scholars like Ibn Taymiyyah,
yes,
accused him, mm-hmm, of supporting the Mongol kings,
yes,
in the victory of Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
When the king, the Mongol king, actually conquered Baghdad, actually he killed the Khalifa or the Baghdad Caliph.
Yes.
They accused Khwaja Nasir that he actually ordered the Mongol king, uh-huh, to kill him and to kill the other, for example, scholars and ulama. But in reality, when the researchers researched about this issue, they found it that no, before Ibn Taymiyyah, no one accused, Khwaja Nasir of such,
yes,
a thing.
Yes.
It was firstly only Ibn Taymiyyah who did such. Rather, Khwaja Nasir caused the king or the situation that many of the scholars, many of the ulama were saved,
yes,
by the help of Khwaja Nasir, by the presence of Khwaja Nasir in Baghdad.
Okay.
Because Khwaja Nasir paid respect to all the scholars,
yes,
either Sunnis or Shias,
yes,
and he tried to convince the king not to, yes, kill the scholars.
Yes.
He actually protected the scholars, the ulama. So this is a kind of false accusation leveled against him by the Ibn Taymiyyah and some of his students.
And the way of,
true.
And the way of converting, we can say, the Mongols into Islam was very much beautiful through science.
Yeah.
You know, showing them, we can say, astronomy, celestial bodies, you know,
exactly,
and saying that, okay, by looking at the celestial bodies, I can predict about your future, the future of your dynasty. So then they become interested in the religion of Islam, in science.
Yeah, of course.
They also funded very much in order.
Yeah.
And in this way, Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi saved many scientists,
exactly,
who were,
yes,
going to be beheaded.
Yeah,
and more importantly, saved many libraries from,
yes,
being burned down. We know that the Timurids, you know, and such Mongol kings, wherever they go, the first thing that they did was burning out all the libraries and the books, mm-hmm, and the textbooks. And this way, Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi saved so many precious books and outstanding scriptures in different languages on that time, which were available in the libraries of Persia on that time. Really beautiful. This shows the akhlaq, somehow how interested the Mongols, who were somehow had barbaric behaviors, you know, now are changed into a calm dynasty, interested in science, interested in looking for knowledge. How a scientist can have role in bringing peace into a society.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha
illallah. Okay, beside all these, what about his religious achievements? I mean, his religious compilations, especially on Islam, what are they?
Well, obviously, because he was a theologian,
yes,
and he had entered the Mongols, we can say like palace, he has access to the Ismailiyun as well.
Yes.
He had access to different places, we can say, which were controlled by highly official or highly powerful people. Therefore, he had influence over these people. And that's why, you know, the Mongols, which were converted to Shia or Islam, obviously, yes, it was due to him. Therefore, we can see that he had basically, he had been making different libraries.
Yes.
And obviously, there were different places where he had his own influence. On the other hand, obviously, from the books that he had,
yes,
we can talk about different books that he had. For example, Asas al-Iqtibas,
yes,
there was Sharh Isharat wa Tanbihat, Bu'ad al-Sina, there was Akhlaq al-Nasiri, and there is another book, Tajreed al-I'tiqad.
This one is very important.
This is one of the important books, which is on the, we can say like it's kind of based on the theology and the philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a merge of both.
Yes.
And about Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi, we should say that he was the first person, according to the historians or, yes, the scholars, who brought philosophy into theology.
Mm-hmm.
Because theology is something which is purely used to be based on the arguments and reasons provided from the Quran and Hadith.
Okay.
For example, a scholar, a theologian scholar who wanted to prove something,
yes,
about God, about the, for example, like prophecy, they used to bring evidences from the Quran, the verses,
yes,
and the ahadith of the Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And their area of reasoning and proving, or the people, that was the Muslim world.
Yes.
Whereas Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi, when he brought like philosophy into it,
yeah,
according to the scholars, he has opened the door for the others as well.
Yes.
That through the intellect, mm-hmm, you can enter the land of Islam, or you can enter the premises of Islam, we can say.
Okay.
So basically, he was one of the great scholars who, in his books, has brought philosophy into the theology. And the proofs that he brought, it was the reasoning the way he did, it was philosophical reasoning and proofs.
Okay, that's all right. Okay, Sheikh, Akhlaq al-Nasiri is another important work of Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi. What is this book exactly?
Yes, Akhlaq al-Nasiri, from its name, it is known as Akhlaq. It is kind of ethical and moral kind of book in which you will find lots of moral instructions,
mm-hmm,
not only for the individuals, but also for the society, for the politician figures, for the family members, for the parents, for different groups of the people. You may find lots of good and helpful and useful instructions.
Yes.
For example, if we go to the details, it has three, let's say, entries. In the first one, we have a kind of introduction to akhlaq, but based on explaining, first of all, the faculties of the nafs or qawa'i nafs.
Yes.
And based on it, then later, Khaja Nasir tries to tell us what to do with this qawa'i nafs, how, mm-hmm, to manage it, how,
yes,
to control it, how to make use of it purposefully and helpfully. And the second entry is, or the second treaty, deals with the family, with how should we live in a family.
Yes.
How should we, for example, train the children? How should we treat or behave with the parents, with the children? What kind of relationship should be there between, mm-hmm, them or among the family members?
Okay, very good.
And the third treaty deals with politics.
Mm-hmm.
He actually, you know, this book was written based on the request was made by one of the rulers of that time, whose name was Nasiruddin.
Yes.
Yeah, Nasiruddin Abdul Rahim ibn Abi Mansur.
That's why it is called Akhlaq al-Nasiri.
Yeah, Akhlaq al-Nasiri is called right. because of this, okay. that he requested Khwaja Nasir to write a kind of moral instructions for him. That's why he wrote that. So he deals with politics as well. Try to tell him, for example, what kind of society is the best society according to the Islamic teachings and doctrines.
Yes.
And how should, for example, the kings treat the people, behave the people.
Okay.
And how should, for example, the people, what are some of the responsibilities of the people regarding the government and the governors?
Very good.
What are the both sides' responsibilities? And yes, what is the, let's say, best kind of qualities that we can find in a very good, for example, Islamic society,
yes.
in a very good political system.
That's right.
So it shows that Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi was one of the scholars who supported political systems or politician in Islam. Yes. He was of the view that we should have a political system.
Establishment of Islamic governance.
Political figures.
Right. Okay.
Because he actually, in this, the third maqala or the third treaty of this, let's say, book, he explicitly explains everything about political systems, political manners, political moralities and ethics.
That's all right. Okay, Sayyid Mohsen, anything missed about Khwaja Nasir?
What about the last book which was mentioned, Akhlaq al-Nasiri? Later, Khwaja Nasiruddin has, wrote a summary of this book with the name of Awsaf al-Ashraf, which was different from his other books because in all his books, you can see like he adopted the philosophical methodology of explaining the things, whereas this was strictly... we can say Awsaf al-Ashraf written on the basis of an Irfani look. And there he obviously bring six, we can say, subtitles into the book, six chapters in which he's explaining about the thing. So we highly recommend, obviously, to the brothers if they can, or the listeners, they can read. They should go for this book. It is a short book, and it's very useful if they want to enter into the a bit towards the, we can say, spiritual.
Yes.
We can say like...
Wayfaring.
Wayfaring, yes.
And teachings. That's all right. Really fruitful life. You was just taking a brief look at his life, in this program, we could understand that how much fruitful his life was from the political, socio-political reform that he had. I mean, the role that he had in socio-political, religious reform of the society at that time. And we know that, as I said, leading a dynasty like the Mongols was a difficult task. And through this way, saving so many, we can say, as we said, scientists and libraries all across the Muslim lands. Also, can say, Maraghe Observatory is still working, for looking out celestial bodies. One of the most ancient observatories all across the world was Maraghe, founded by Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi. Zilhijjah 18th, 672, according to the lunar Hijri calendar, is a day that Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi passed away. According to his will and testament, his body was taken into Al-Kadhimiyah, and he is buried just very much close in vicinity of the tombs Imam Al-Jawad and Imam Musa Al-Kazim alayhi salam, in the city of Al-Kadhimiyah by his own will. This shows very much that he belonged to Isna Shari, we can say Imamiyah, a school of thought and not a smiley or something else. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Shaykh Rouhani for a nice elaboration regarding the life of Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
فیلم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the holy prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. The second condition after wish of heart in order to be nurtured divinely is having knowledge. As soon as I wish in heart to be nurtured in my spirituality, I must try hard to gain knowledge in this regard. Spiritual wayfaring is exactly like physical exercise. We must be under the tutelage of a trainer, because the trainer has the knowledge. He knows how to help us. Now, the best trainer of our soul is Imam al-Mahdi. We are under his watch every moment and minute of our lives.
خدا نکنه اسم ما رو خط بزنه بگه این دیگه آدم باشه و بگی نیست.
God forbid if Imam al-Mahdi loses hope in nurturing us, we won't be able to restart our spiritual journey. This is what Imam as-Sadiq alayhi salam told about Abu Muslim al-Khurasani. Abu Muslim wanted to serve Imam as-Sadiq alayhi salam and wrote a letter to him. However, the Imam didn't accept his request, because Abu Muslim did not act based on the exact teachings of the Imam of his time, Imam al-Mahdi. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at stories through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll take a look at trending news, and this week we're looking at historical stories which have a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to celebrate one of the golden ages of Islamic history, the 800-year period the Muslims ruled over what is modern-day Spain and Portugal. The anniversary of the end of that glorious period falls in the month of January, which is a great opportunity for Muslims to reflect on what made Muslim Spain or Al-Andalus so great.
In January 1492, the last Muslim kingdom of Al-Andalus, better known as Muslim Spain, fell to the Catholic monarchs, putting an end to 800 years of glorious Islamic civilization. The Muslim presence in the Iberian Peninsula was a time when religious tolerance, sophisticated scholarship, glorious architecture, and a superior lifestyle prevailed. Muslim Spain is now best known by the glories of its architecture, such as the Alhambra Palace in Granada, one of Europe's most visited monuments. But it was perhaps the Cordoba Caliphate from the 8th to 11th centuries which personified Al-Andalus at its height, with Muslims, Jews, and Christians all intermingling and flourishing under Muslim rule. By the 15th century, the Christians had begun to squeeze the Muslims. But the real impetus for the fall of Granada was when Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile married to unite the two largest Christian kingdoms. These monarchs had a vision of a uniquely Catholic nation. Around 100,000 Muslims were subsequently killed or enslaved, and 200,000 fled. Later, a decree would be ordered, forcing those who remained to convert to Christianity on pain of death. The Catholic monarchs also passed a decree expelling all Jews or forcing them to convert, again on pain of death.
Well, later on in the show, we'll be talking to two experts on Islamic Spain. But first, joining us in the studio today is Roshan Mohamed Saleh, who is the editor of the Muslim news website Five Pillars. Roshan is a very frequent visitor to the historic Muslim areas of modern-day Spain and has kindly agreed to share his experiences with us today. Roshan, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on, as always. Just tell me, what's your view of Islamic Spain? Tell me about your experiences there.
Well, I've been there about 10 times over the years, and the last time was only about a month and a half ago. And I just think it's the most beautiful part of Europe. I think, and especially if you're a Muslim and you're interested in Islamic history, like every Muslim should be, then Andalusia in the southern part of Spain, where the Muslim influence is the strongest, is the place to go. And I could recommend a few places, like Granada is the obvious place with the Alhambra Palace, which is probably the most beautiful monument in Europe. It's just an amazing place, a fortress and several palaces. Then there's the Mesquita or the mosque, the Grand Mosque of Cordoba, which is literally one of the most beautiful mosques in the whole world. And even Masjid al-Nabawi in Medina, it's modeled on the Mesquita in Cordoba, the famous arches. And there are other, you know, beautiful places like there's a fortress in Malaga, there's a Muslim tower in Seville. So it's literally, and the landscape will remind lots of Muslims of North Africa as well, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, you know, mountainous olive trees everywhere. It's just a really beautiful place.
Now, I'm pretty embarrassed to say I haven't been yet, unfortunately.
Okay, you must go.
I must go, but interesting enough, you've written about the sadness you feel when you visit this region as well. Could you explain that to
me? Yeah, so it's kind of, I always have mixed feelings because I'm really happy to be there. But when you visit some of these Muslim monuments, you know, they've been desecrated by the Christians. After the fall of Granada in 1492, the Catholic monarchs in particular, they had this policy of desecrating Qurans and just generally denigrating Muslim culture. So
forced
the Alhambra...
Forced conversions.
Yeah, exactly. And the Alhambra, for example, they built a kind of a palace, a Christian-style palace right in the middle of the Alhambra, which looks really incongruous next to the Muslim architecture. They did the same thing in the Grand Mosque of Cordoba. They put a Christian cathedral right in the middle of that mosque. So they basically vandalized it. And, you know, when you go to these places, you can't pray, for example. If you try to pray as a Muslim, even though there's a mihrab there, you know, direction of the prayer, you know, you're ready to pray, but they won't let you pray. They'll physically stop you from praying. You could get arrested if you pray. So it's just a reminder of what we lost. And the fact is that we're not allowed to celebrate it properly in modern day Muslim Spain.
Yes, it's interesting you mention those points, because there surely are some Muslims still left in Spain. What's the community like there?
Limited. There's a bit of immigration, kind of like, menial labour from places like Morocco especially, but, you know, Tunisia and other places in North Africa and, you know, sub-Saharan Africa as well. But the Muslim presence in Spain is less than it would be in other European countries, like the UK, for example, where we have 4 million plus Muslims, France, where there's 6 million plus Muslims. It's much less. I think it's well under a million in Spain. And that's because there's been a deliberate policy of, kind of keeping the Muslim presence in Spain quite small. Mosques, for example, regularly are denied building permits. There are a few mosques now, but there aren't many mosques. But still, you can see the vestiges of Muslim Spain, and even the faces of the people, because lots of Spaniards, Christian Spaniards, were originally Arabs, and they have Arab blood in them. Even the Spanish language has lots of Arabic words. The food, and it permeates every aspect of life, but sometimes you have to look for it.
Yes, and I know that there are still place names which originate from the Arabic language.
Absolutely.
That haven't changed, that type of thing. And I wonder, very briefly, Roshan, Islamophobia is a European-wide phenomena. It's a problem across the board. But in Spain, would you say that it's worse because of this issue? They're trying to stamp out Muslim culture?
Absolutely. They were doing that because, you know, the policy once 1492 happened, it was eradication of Islam. And that has served as a blueprint for even for modern societies. France is going down that route in many ways. Not physical extermination, but extermination of a religion. And lots of European societies. So even the influence of, you know, the Spanish Inquisition, for example, it permeates into modern life even today.
Well, Roshan, we are going to come back to you later on in the show, if I'm not mistaken. But for the time being, I want to move on and take a look at what people on social media have been saying about the anniversary of Al-Andalus and its fall in modern-day Spain.
Twitter has become awash with opinions regarding the legacy of Islamic Spain. Muslims hold Al-Andalus in high regard and praise the period as a shining example of an Islamic region leading in tolerance and enlightenment.
One of the most understudied pieces of human history, the impact this caliphate had on knowledge building alone is tremendous to today's modern society. May this serve as a reminder for all, regardless of religion or culture, to appreciate Muslim contributions to history. Alhamdulillah, since its arrival, Islam has still been there longer than it hasn't. May bring back the Nur that illuminated Europe and by extension the world. Ameen.
Some non-Muslims use the occasion to troll Muslims and praise the collapse of Islamic rule in the Iberian Peninsula.
People of Spain are so happy they drove the invaders back to where they belonged. Spain grew to be a great nation and an empire. They helped greatly to push back the Ottomans and keep them away from total defeat of Europe.
While other Muslims believe lessons should be learned about Muslims and their trust for the un-Islamic world.
It's what happens when you sit on your laurels and you're not alerted to the plots of the disbelievers. You have to never trust the disbelievers and must be permanently on high alert to defend yourself and spread your cause. Today again we are trusting them whilst they plot our destruction. Many of the traits for which modern US prides itself comes from Muslim Spain, who achieved these traits first. Diplomacy, free trade, open borders, techniques of academic research, anthropology, fashion, algorithms, medicine, hospitals, etc. But the only thing the West associates us with is terrorism.
Well, I'm honoured to declare that we have another guest joining us now to add to this discussion, Dr. Uthman Latif, a celebrated Muslim author, a renowned historian, teacher and lecturer based here in Britain. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. Now, firstly, just start off by telling us why you think Islamic Spain was so great in your view.
I think for a few reasons. One, because Spain is recognised as Al-Andalus. In fact, that period is called by historians as the convivencia, as the coexistence between Muslims, Jews, and Christians, an unparalleled kind of moment in human history where Jews, Christians, and Muslims could thrive under Islamic rule in Islamic Spain. So we have, of course, a great kind of legacy of achievement under great rulers like Abdulrahman III, Al-Hakam II, the building of schools, of universities, of hospitals,